What do I do?
You do like, ow! Hey guys,
Ow!
this is Coogan Chronicles podcast. I'm Chris Marquette.
And that was AJ Trouth. And we are your hosts for the Coogan Chronicles. We're using it, AJ. We're rolling with it. I'm not doing it again.
I feel sorry for everybody that had to listen to it, but that's fine. Let's just go with it.
Okay, we're going to start off this podcast every episode apologizing to everyone listening. That's just what we're going to do. We're just going to say, sorry you're here, guys. I'm sorry. What are you going to do about it? If you haven't shut us off, that's our new intro. We're going to cut one day. We're going to strike gold, baby. One day we're going to make it. We're going to hit it rich. We're just going to find the sweet spot and we're never looking back. That's the deal. Until then, thanks for sticking with us. Again, we're a podcast of two former child actors interviewing
Other former child actors.
yeah, about what it was like for them hanging out on sets and going on
And just hanging
auditions,
out in
just
general.
hanging out. Well, this is our intro today, guys, is we wanted to shed a little light, look at the wizard behind the curtain, so to speak, and give you a little tidbit about real life as a former kid actor. And that's this. There's a stone cold fact to being a young actor. So any actor in as a teenager into their 20s, it is really safe to say that about 90 to 95% of them, if they're not working or auditioning, they are just hanging out with each other. That's it.
Just doing nothing. Just calling up their friend
Literally.
Chris saying, hey, what's going on? Oh, nothing. Just playing Mario Kart at my apartment. You want to come over? Yeah, I'll be over in 5 minutes. And then you play Mario Kart for
For
seven
10
hours a day.
hours. Yeah, exactly. Multiple times a day until someone gets an audition. That is literally it. And that is not just our generation. That is not just our group of friends. That is every single. I know kid actors that are kid actors right now. I know a couple of awesome actors that are about 10 years younger than I am, brothers, and they're great. And they're like super successful. They're friends with all the other little successful kid actors out there. They're hanging with all the Stranger Things kids and the Game of Thrones kids. All those kids, everybody's just hanging out with each other. They're not
Which is so
doing
different
anything.
from being like a young athlete or something, where you're training 8 hours a day or whatever it is. You know what your schedule is. As a young actor, you make your own schedule, and it's also that thing where you call your friend and there's that one day where they go, oh, sorry, I can't do it. I've got an audition. And you're like, oh, God, really? You
God
got an
damn it.
audition?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it literally gets in the way of the only other priority in life, which is to do nothing, to like sit around and do nothing. And it looks like maybe, oh yeah, they're in the gym. They're probably reading books. They're probably traveling. It's not the truth. No. Like they'll do that occasionally, but for the most part, you're anchored to sitting around waiting for auditions. And so in the meantime, you are doing nothing. You're just waiting. You're waiting around
Now,
and
maybe
you're all
this was
chilling.
just our group. Maybe this was just our group of
It's
friends,
not.
because maybe there's a group of young actors that are learning martial arts, or they're learning foreign
No, dude.
languages, they're
No,
learning
dude.
how to
It's well,
speak
see,
with
that's why
accents.
I said 90 to 95%, because there are 5 to
Right.
10% of kids that are doing some other interesting things. But 90% of them are not. They're definitely not. AJ and I hung out with every former famous kid actor you can literally think of in our generation, and some that were a bit older and some a little bit younger. And the trend hasn't stopped. I really mean it. Like, I've worked with some other kid actors the last 5 years, and the trend hasn't stopped. They're still just all hanging out.
Which begs the question, is the ultimate goal to live a life of acting all the time, or is the ultimate goal to live a life of hanging out all the
For
time?
you, it was to hang out for sure. For you were totally satisfied just walking off set to punch a ticket and then hang out. I'm almost positive of that. I was always biding my. I always felt like I was just itching to get to the next little job or something like that. So I think it depends. But at the same time, I think what I wanted to get at with that is just how unorthodox that is. Like, there's just not many people that aren't then either looking to fortify a future, or struggling to find a future, or in college, or in their first job. Not many people in their early mid-20s, even the late 20s, are just farting around, doing nothing, waiting for a call from their agent for their next audition, and all hanging out with each other. Like, I mean, for you and me and all of our friends, we called each other the Lost Boys. We're like, that's how we felt. We felt like we were in Neverland, and we had no parents and nowhere to go and nothing to do
And
except
it's not like
play
there was
ping
no
pong.
traveling going on. Nobody was like going to Europe or South America or going on
No,
adventures because you had to
I
wait
don't.
around for an audition
Well,
occasionally,
that's
maybe every
exactly it
once in a
is.
while.
There
You had to
are
be
some of
there
those
for
trips.
auditions.
Exactly. There are some of those trips, but they're very rare and they're very hard to pull the trigger on. They really are. Like, all of our, a few of our friends went to Europe. I joined them, but I joined them like it was a month long trip. I joined them 3 weeks in because I had a couple auditions I had to change. And then I was too scared to actually book the ticket because I thought, man, I was about to, and I just got these big auditions. So fuck it, man, I can't do it. And then I finally just booked it and then left early. Because they got a call.
And then like, just crossed your fingers that your agent didn't call with an audition because you didn't tell him that you left. And you're like, exactly. Okay, I'll just fly back if I get one, but hopefully I don't.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And so I don't know if people realize how tethered, a young actor's life is to their auditions and work. And that on the flip side of that, if they're not doing that, they're just out at bars or clubs or hanging out in each other's living rooms doing nothing with their lives, but all together. And that's, I think, you know, why we've initially had so many of our friends on this podcast is, you know, we farted around a lot with each other hanging out and made a lot of cool friends. And it is a nice part of the entire thing. It's just absurd when I think about it. Like the farther away from it I get, the more absurd I realize it is. Where I'm like, well, what did we spend? Everybody I knew spent a good 10 to 15 years just chilling, just like at coffee shops and clubs and bars.
It's an early retirement. You know, it's what actors all, it's like you live your retirement in your early to mid 20s, and then you just have to work into your 70s and 80s to make up for it.
Shit gets real in your 30s and you're like, okay, got to get it together now. That's exactly what it is. That is the life. And I think a majority of former kid actors will attest to that fact. So guys, today, we have a good buddy of ours named Raviv Ullman. We're still hanging out with Raviv. In fact, we have a surf club with Raviv. We all go surfing together with Lou Pucci and Raviv and Aaron Himmelstein and a few other people you guys will get to hear from on this podcast at some point. So we're still just farting around hanging out with each other. Most of you probably know Raviv Ullman as Phil from Phil the Future. We know Raviv from extenuous, deeply conflicting and complicated rap battles. In our respective rap groups. We get into that quite a bit in this podcast at some point, so definitely don't tune out before you get to that little part. And what else you got to say about Raviv, AJ?
How much you love that's him? That's it. Raviv of the Wilton Hilton, Raviv of Acoustic Nights. Oh, yeah, the Wilton Hilton.
Yep. I don't even know if we mentioned that in here. The Wilton Hilton was a big house that he lived in that had the nickname the Wilton Hilton. And as we get into it, you'll see, you know, it was on Wilton Place in Hollywood. And right smack dab in the middle of Hollywood. And it was just a big old house with tons of big parties. The Wilton Hilton, baby. But go ahead. What else about Raviv?
I was just going to say, both you and Raviv were the glue that held a lot of us together. You guys were the social organizers. You were the social organizer for our sort of smaller orbit. And Raviv was the social organizer for his orbit. And you guys would get all of us together frequently. And you guys still do that.
We still do it.
And I'm grateful. And I'm grateful to both of you for it.
You are. Yeah. What would all of our friends be without us, huh? Nothing. And and that's why we went head to head as rap group aficionados, as rappers head to head. That's what we did. Before there was Lil Dicky, there was Demcracker Blackjacks and the Weeby Boys. Let me just let everybody know. Raviv was part of the Weeby Boys. I don't know how they got that name. Anyway, guys, without further ado, Raviv Ullman.
In not knowing where to start with you, Raviv, this is something Chris and I commonly come up against with friends that we've known for a really long time. And that is that I'm like, I don't know, maybe I'm frustrated by it or saddened by it. The fact that we've been friends this long and know nothing, really nothing about this part of your life. I know nothing about your life as an actor, really. And very, very little about your life starting acting. We were all super young when we first got to know each other. And I don't know what your experience was, but it felt like something we never really talked about. Like it was this taboo subject. We didn't, at least in my experience, again, we didn't talk about work really. I don't recall any conversations with you talking about acting.
That's interesting. I absolutely agree. I know that, like, I don't know how, growing up, I went to public school and my friends were not actors at all. You know, they were into sports or they were, you know, I had friends that were definitely into like high school theater and a couple friends that were like seriously into it. But that's not what my social circle was based on as a kid. And then I feel like when I moved to LA and we all became friends, the thing that at least for me attracted me to all of you guys and to our group of friends was that we weren't talking about the industry, that it didn't feel hobnobby and elbow rubby because we were kids. Like we were just teenagers trying to be teenagers. And there are parts of that I like look back at and I'm like, maybe I should have been a little more business savvy about things. But I was.
My impression of a lot of our friends, a lot of our big social circle was, you know, when you move to LA from somewhere else to pursue acting, you end up here you know, without a home. Like you come here and you've come here just with that endeavor, not because you went, I like LA, let's plant there. And then maybe if this acting thing works out, you're going specifically for that reason. Mm-hmm. So I always felt like me and all my friends were a bit of like the Lost Boys. You know, we like all kind of came together with a common background, but not because of it.
Yeah. And look, I definitely don't hold anything against anyone that had that experience or whose circle of friendship was based on that. But I think because so many of us started when we were so young. I mean, I was listening to the Maddie episode. She started when she was 2. I started when I was 8.
How did you start, especially if your world is like, if most of your peers in public school are just into the normal things, like kids would be like sports or chess club or whatever it's going to be, you know? So how what's your segue into acting or singing? I know you have a background in. And
I started in a very cool way. I was a very young kid doing plays for my stuffed animals because it's the only audience that I could get, I'm told by my mother. And so I remember being, I think I was 7 years old in the local library, and there was an acting camp that was hopping around town, like promoting their production of Amelia Bedelia that they were doing. And they came to the library to do like a couple musical numbers for people. And it was the first time that I saw kids performing for an actual audience and actually putting on a play. It like blew my mind.
And you were like, fuck you, stuffed animals.
I'm done with you assholes.
I got a real live audience waiting for me.
Yeah, pretty much. And I asked my mom if I could do the camp like the next year. And I met the people and they're like, yeah, come audition next year. And I did. And I booked the role of Peter in Peter Pan.
Wow.
And it was just hooked.
But
did you intend that? Yeah.
It's a good pun. Yeah.
Always. No, I really I couldn't get enough of it. It was kind of a eureka moment. And I did that camp for many years and then did community theater. It was all theater based everything, and loved musical theater. I was in my Hebrew day school, walking through the hallways, singing the libretto to Les Mis. And a teacher stopped me and said, oh, you like musical theaters? And at the age of 8 or whatever, well, do I? And and her daughter was a professional actress in New York and had a manager. And she offered to introduce me to her daughter's manager. And that Terry Saperstein has been my manager for 25 years.
Wow. No really? Way.
Wow.
Yeah.
Forgive me if I'm wrong, but you lived in Connecticut at that time.
Yeah.
And then you go from Connecticut to New York, which isn't a long train ride. And is that how your life all of a sudden evolves? She says, I know a manager in New York, and you're like on a train soon.
Yeah,
after.
Pretty much. Met that management company and then was just started to go on auditions. And I think that's when I got serious about things. So I'd been doing community theater stuff and acting camp stuff, and then started to get serious about voice lessons and realized that if I was going to compete in New York, I had to be really serious about it, and started auditioning for, you know, regional stuff and for Broadway and national tour. Soon after that, went on the national tour of The King and I and hopped around with that production, and then just kind of kept moving from there and really not thought of myself as a theater actor, but that, because that's what I was, but thought that that's where my career was going to be heading to. Like, film and television felt like a world away, and I enjoyed making movies with my friends, and like I enjoyed the world of filmmaking, but thought that I was on a path to be like a song and dance man in New York. Huh.
And when you would go on these tours, would your parents go with you, or do you do that?
My grandfather, yeah. Well, because The King and I specifically, I was 11 when I did it. So both of my parents worked. My dad has done a million different jobs over the years. He had a printing business at the time. My mom was a teacher. And so my grandfather came out with me for the majority of those 10 months traveling around the country.
So just
he was
you
kind
and
of my guy. Yeah, me and grandpa.
You and grandpa out there.
Seeing the world.
Yeah. And what is that like? Are you guys, you go in a hotel to hotel and you share a room together and you got the double bed and you're like, good night, grandpa.
That's
and you
it.
Guys go, that's, and that's that life.
Was he supporting that city? Dream? He loved
obviously,
this whole thing.
Yeah.
I think he had a great time. I mean, because, you know, the kids, just like in television and film and on sets, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but theater is the same thing. And Chris, I know you've done theater, like adults have a show at night or maybe two shows during the day on a weekend, but the rest of the day they get to run around and see the city and whatever that is. The kids go to school all day and then go do the show. So we would go to school and he'd have the day to like go explore Denver or you know, Kansas City or wherever we were.
Pretty good yeah. job. I gotta imagine.
Yeah,
you know, we went dog sledding in the Rockies and like we saw shit all over the country.
Wow.
I still have, even I was 11 and 12, but I have really like fierce memories from that time of like exploring for the first time and being able to tie that to what I love doing. So I loved being on stage. So during the day we get, you know, if we weren't in school, we get to explore a new place. And yeah, and you feel like, you know, at 11, I felt like an adult. I really felt like, oh, I am out on my own. I got grandpa holding my hand, but like seeing the world and being an actor and being on stage with 47 other people at night and 12 tractor trailers running, like feeling on top of the world. So.
And it is an adult vibe too. You know, I mean, there is like, you do show up and, you know, The King and I does have a lot of kids in it in the production, but it's predominantly adults, right? Like it's
definitely
like
predominantly adults.
70-30 or something.
Back then when I think of all of the adults in the cast, I now realize that they were probably 19 years old.
Okay.
But at the time they were definitely adults. Yeah. But you have real responsibility. Like you have to show up, you got to sign in, you got to stand on your marks, you got to sing the song, you got to hit the harmonies, you know, you're working. And I love that. And I think that love for the opportunity for what work could bring with an adventure, what an adventure could bring with work, like that's still very exciting to me.
So it sounds like success came to you relatively quickly and easily from a young age.
At the time, I probably felt like success. It also felt like I've set out to do this thing and it's working. Not that I'm going to be a star or that all of my wildest dreams came true so much as like, this is what I want to do. I'm putting a lot of work into it and I'm seeing the return on that. And I think a lot of my career has, when I've worked, has felt like that, that like, this isn't the thing that's going to lead to the thing that's going to blow up. But it's like, this is the work. I want to work and I want to be on set. I want to be in a theater. I want to be in a rehearsal room. And when that's happening, I feel like it's working. But yeah, you know, I definitely found work early on and I'm very grateful for that.
And it seems like it was a smooth sort of transition then from you going from your literally performing with your stuffed animals to on tour with your grandpa almost, you know, it's like, you know, from a conversation to an agent to auditioning in New York to doing a play to going around the country with a play. And that's not a one foot in, one foot out scenario. Your whole life has changed. You're out of school. You're away from your parents. Your life changes. And so, and that looks, sounds like it continues right in your life. Like it just sort of was a steady flow of theater work until what, you start doing film and television at some point, or like when does it?
I guess so, but it doesn't feel like that in real time, you know, because you're not jumping from job to job. It's way more weird, especially as a kid, because you go home to your hometown, you go back to public school, and then you're with a bunch of kids who don't really know you, and you like have to re-find yourself and refit into something that is out of your world. But you were just out touring the country, being in a play, and now you're in public school again, and then you're auditioning, and then for a year you don't book anything, and you're like, oh, I guess that was a fluke. And looking back, it definitely feels like, oh, and then you do this, and then you do this, and then you're working, and you just keep working. But I don't know anybody that hasn't had a ride of it, and not, you know, some people are really supportive and some people are not. And I've only held on to like a couple friends from that time, because I don't think I made that many really tight friends during that time. I feel like, I don't know if you guys have this experience, but the closest friends that I've had my entire life have been people that I'm totally okay with not seeing or talking to for 2 years and then picking up where we left off. And a lot of people are not okay with that type of friendship. You know? Right.
So what was the point where that part of your life was totally behind you, where you were done with going back and forth from acting to school and you'd built enough momentum that you knew now I'm just staying with this acting train and I'm going to be doing school on set or doing home. Did you ever end up getting homeschooled or did you end up graduating from a regular high school?
Yeah. So that moment was when I booked Phil of the Future for Disney and moved to Los Angeles. I was junior in high school, went to public school, was in and out, just like you're saying, going off to shoot something, coming back, going for a job, coming back, booked that and knew that that was going to take up at least all of my senior year. And from then that was going to be done. So my school was cool about it and let me take the classes on set that I would need to graduate and transfer them back. So I got to walk with my class and got my diploma from there. But that was the moment.
Because you didn't cut ties even then with your school or anything. It's not like you said, oh, cool, a book TV show, going to Hollywood, peace. And just like,
I think my parents were really helpful in pushing like, let's get you a high school diploma.
Yeah.
So if it were up to you, you would have just been like, oh, fuck it, I'm out of here. Yeah. Peace out, guys.
Out. Yeah. I missed so much school. I missed so much school because living in Connecticut, to get to New York in time for an audition meant that I almost always had to miss last period. And sometimes I'd have 3 or 4 auditions a week, you know? And so I was always missing last period, whatever that period happened to be. If I was lucky, it was like a study hall period. It never was. It was always math or science or something where it was going to absolutely fuck me later on. And so I was never a great student to begin with. I passed classes, but was not interested in my grades. And it was a deal that my parents cut with me when I was in middle school. They're like, look, we will support this and you can continue to do this, but you have to pass. You have to get at least a B for us to let you go in and audition. And so I worked just hard enough to be able to get through and would often be gone. But I knew that it's what I wanted to do. I also thought that I wanted to be and still kind of have this dream of like working in cinematography and behind the camera. And so I knew that if I was going to go to school at all at the time, it was going to be for cinematography, for film or something like that. And felt like I was at least working towards that. But at that point, moving to LA, I was like, let's get this chapter behind me and focus on work.
That's interesting because we read this. So, you know, we like Google everybody, even if we know them and stuff. The article that we saw has this breakdown, right, of your life. It has this breakdown where it kind of like went over the facts for us, at least not knowing these about you, which was the start of your career and being in Connecticut, and that you were, it said like you were in a ballet class when you heard you booked Phil of the Future, and then you moved to LA, and then it talks about how like you didn't know why the show ended on a cliffhanger, and then you eventually moved to New York, and it goes over all the other things you've worked on, and you move to New York and you do this great off-Broadway show, and then your life with social media takes hold, and then on top of it, then all of a sudden you have this whole new relationship with a fan base that you had from, you know, your whole career. For you, when you hear something like that, what's missing in there?
Like I said, I think it's like there's always so much in between, and I think of my career as my career, not my entire life. What I see as my career has taken so many different shapes, not just being an actor. You know, I'm working in documentary films now, and I've spent a lot of time directing like music video and commercial work, and like, yeah, was really into dance for a long time, and spend a lot of time making videos with a puppet. And like, there's all these different aspects that to me at the time, or working on a podcast, like when I'm working on them, that is my career. And that is what I'm focusing on and put all my energy into. What is most forward facing is being an actor. And so definitely the different phases of acting feel like in a way their own chapter, even though they've been spread out over the course of 30 years. But in my thinking of my own life, like that's not all I think about or remember. You know, that's like one aspect of a career that brought some success, brought a lot of failure, brought me all over the world, and definitely had a huge effect on my life. But I see it as a piece of the puzzle of my life, I guess.
How do you feel like that has watermarked the rest of your career moving forward? Because you have done so many other things. When I think of you, I never think of, oh, Raviv from Disney Channel. That would be the former actor.
Yeah, you, it would you be think like of Raviv, this very creative, artistic person who's always up to something interesting.
Next.
You don't ever seem like someone who, one, has been beholden to your time as a Disney actor in particular, or haunted by being a child actor at all either.
But it's interesting because I look at you and I'm like, you've had far more success than I have. Just, and I'm not to compare, but I'm like, well, you've been in films that went to the movie theaters. I've never had a film in movie theaters. So there's so many different ways to compare and contrast what success is like, which is why I think it's helpful, or why I've never been able to just look back and be like, let's go back to there. Because again, what does that look like trying to get another series regular on Disney Channel? I don't know what.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think there's a specific plan. I think there's a commonality to when you end up finding a lot of success and value as when you're young, especially as a teenager, when you're really coming to your own as an adult anyway, you know, that can, as AJ knows, I put it like watermark your life. You know, it can start to give you a standard or shape what you believe your life should look like and will look like. And that is something that can get dragged around or, you know, I think become sometimes for people more of a burden.
If I'm being totally honest with myself, do I not look around at some of the other people who are leads on Disney shows and think, what the heck, what happened? You know, it's not like I fully decided to not seek out success in acting. But what happened to Zac Efron and Vanessa Hudgens, like what happened to that whole crew, like didn't happen to me. And it wasn't necessarily by choice. I have a lot of interest and very thrilled and passionate about all the other things I get to work on. I don't think there was a time where I was like, I am done with this chapter and want to start something new. I don't know that I never ever pined for that in my own head or wonder if there were missteps that I took along the way. And I think that part of being an actor, and especially when you start so young, is having a lot of self-doubt. I mean, we all know we have so many insanely neurotic friends that have, like, way beyond the three of us, that have a hard time coming to terms with what we did or did not achieve. And I am not free of that. Mm-hmm. But I do think that I know that the only thing I can do is look forward and apply that same level of energy, that same level of passion that I had back then. I looked in the mirror not too long ago and I was like, I was thinking I'm not auditioning for wide-eyed characters anymore. That was my thing that I was like bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And then I looked in the mirror, I was like, oh, because I'm not wide-eyed anymore. Like, I'm just not. Yeah. You know, I'm in my 30s now and I'm a little more tired and things aren't as wondrous.
Tired and bushy-tailed. That's okay. That's a character too.
Tired and bushy-tailed.
Are you...
That's my thing.
Were there Disney Channel roles that you turned down at a certain point? Were you saying like, I don't want to keep doing the work for this channel and I'm moving on to more adult roles or?
No, there was not. I think that there were maybe a couple like guest spots or something that I did or didn't do, but I did not break up with that relationship. And as far as I could tell, especially at the time, it felt like they were doing a couple, two or three seasons of a show and then moving on.
Right.
And especially since they're a kids network. So obviously they kept some relationships with certain people, or at least over decades have revisited certain relationships. But at the time, and AJ, you could speak to this probably, but it felt like they did a show. And when that show was canceled, maybe you did a guest spot or a TV movie or something, but it's not like then you were going to work on every Disney Channel thing that was out there.
Right.
I think that there are a couple actors who, like Brenda Song, I think, like jumped around and did a bunch of different TV shows. But for like for the most part, we had that chapter. That chapter ended, and then maybe you were gonna, you know, do a Disney feature or something like that. But they were gonna go do the next kids show, and we were all becoming young adults.
Right. Yeah.
But maybe I'm wrong about that.
No, that sounds right.
I've always thought, actually, you know, AJ told me before this, because I was like, okay, so Raviv had done this and this. And in that interview, you said you booked Phil of the Future and then the Disney Channel puts you in another movie prior to the TV show just to introduce you to the Disney audience. And I said, it's a movie called Pixel Perfect. And AJ goes, oh, I was up for that movie.
Well, I mean, there's a funny thing here, Raviv. And you and I have never talked about this.
We haven't, no.
My introduction to you a little bit was like, there was a phase of my career for Disney Channel that you did where it was elite. There's two stories I'll share with you. So one is this story actually comes to me by way of my ex-wife, which is she did Pixel Perfect with you.
Right.
And she was told by the producer, who's a friend of mine, Alan Sachs, and Alan Sachs
love
and I did,
Alan Sachs.
Did You Wish together the year before, I believe.
Wow.
And I had an audition for Pixel Perfect. And she was told that AJ Trout, the guy who plays Twitty on Even Stevens, is going to be in Pixel Perfect with you. And then you showed up on set and she's like, oh, I guess it's not the guy that was doing it. But I was fairly certain I was going to play that part in Pixel Perfect. So then the Phil of the Future story is as well, Sean McNamara was producing it at the time, right?
Yeah.
Or he was directing the pilot.
Yep.
And Sean also produced Even Stevens. And I feel like I've told this story on the podcast before maybe. But anyway, Sean pulls me into his office and says, AJ, I really need you to play this part. You're going to do this thing for me. And we're going to play Phil. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to do Disney Channel anymore, Sean. So come on, it's going to be great. You got to do it. Okay, fine. So I go and I audition for Phil of the Future. And I'm testing in LA. And I'm testing. And it's just me testing. And I test with two different families, like family A and family B. There's a mom and a dad and a sister, or what I forget what the characters were. And then there was family B with a mom and a dad and a sister character and all that stuff. So I was fairly certain. I was like, well, of course I'm playing the part of Phil. There's these two families here. There's only one of me. So it's going to be one of these families. And then I'm going to play the part of Phil. And then I didn't get either of those jobs. Raviv Ullman got got both those jobs.
How does that make you feel?
You know,
yeah, we've been going over this.
It's a lot of therapy. Well,
it's been a lot of therapy.
I feel totally fine about it today. But the funny part is in meeting you for the first time when you came to LA, there was definitely that little tinge of a thing in my 15-year-old brain of like,
sure,
the whiplash that is associated with.
Well, I just want to point out too, for now in the retelling and from an outside perspective, there's something to when you retell a story that like the producer sits you down on the set you're already working on. He's like, AJ, you got to do this thing for me. And you're like, Sean, I don't even know if I want to do Disney.
Yeah.
Who's like singing and dancing in the hallways and who is bright eyed and bushy tailed. And he comes in and they're like, this kid's fucking great, man. And they're like, all right, let's get out of AJ. Let's get out of the AJ world.
I think maybe I was already jaded a little bit. I was already like,
you were already stubbing out your cigarette butts.
And I mean, we can all say as soon as we show up to LA, that you know the jading happens immediately.
Yeah, it's just in the air, smog and jaded.
And there's something that I wonder about. Is like, is that kind of competition that we had felt, that the competition in itself, and maybe you guys have talked about this on the show, has like that ride of me feeling competitive has been such a ride, because there have been times where I felt no competition towards any of my friends ever, and maybe that's when I'm working and happy, and so maybe that's when that like, I've never really traced it, and sometimes I feel like really intense about it.
That's very hard to reconcile in your mind, and I think that was the first time I'd actually experienced maybe like disappointment or defeat in that way, was thinking things were going to go one way and then them being changed. Then there was also, Chris, you know, the Jonas Brothers story with the Jake Long theme song of being my band being replaced by the Jonas Brothers on that thing. It's like these little series of defeats. I think it was very defining for my young 15, 16-year-old brain to go through those moments.
It's definitely all a huge head spin. And going through those processes, and I guess I'm answering my own question here, but like, and maybe, I don't know, maybe not. Maybe for kids who are into sports, like the golden egg was getting, you know, accepted to a great college, and that was going to be the thing that changed your life. Like, I remember being in a hotel in LA, having tested for Phil, and being like, if this happens, everything does turn upside down. And not even like, I'm going to be a star, but like, I'm going to leave living with my family and going to public school and have a home in Los Angeles and go to work at 6 a.m. every morning and have to learn how to pay bills and do my own laundry. But I also don't, have we talked about this? I don't know if we've talked about that. I feel like we may have talked about this just in person, but like, I don't have a memory of meeting you guys. Like, I don't know when.
We just all of a sudden just knew each other.
Maybe
just,
AJ did, because you like had your laser beams on me.
The only time I remember, which I'd love to talk about because it's such a fascinating, I feel like, chapter of all of our friends' lives, is I remember I lived in Hollywood and you lived at the Wilton Hilton. And and so you're at this house on Wilton Street in Hollywood, mm-hmm, with a bunch of other actors and musicians and creative people. And I lived down the road in this apartment complex, apartment building with like, that was also filled with a bunch of actors and different apartments and stuff. So some roommating with each other. But all I remember is there was just this 4-block radius where there's tons of actors and musicians. And you started to have these really cool, interesting parties where you would throw.
That just
like,
added to the mystique, Raviv, because you were always the coolest.
And that's all
the amazing parties.
I did not see myself at that as that, like, in the slightest.
Well, that's what's funny is I didn't even know you lived there or through these parties, because you didn't get it. You weren't like, welcome to my home, guy. Like, there was none of that. I just thought you were hanging out there as well. And that's it. That's the only, I don't remember a definitive time. I just remember all of a sudden that's where we're in each other's orbit. I want to say that a little while you would have these like music stand up or like, maybe it was all just music nights. And I feel like people rolled through there pre sometimes giant stardom, like Katy Perry, I think, was in there for a while, hanging out with you guys and performing. And then there was like, I don't know, there was a couple friends of mine, I know there were actors that I think they were performing too, because I didn't go often, but every now and then somebody like, dude, last night was great. So-and-so got up there and just jammed out for a while. And then, so it became a little strange, awesome, like event that happened all the time. And I feel like that'd be an interesting thing.
Yeah, that was all born. We had a lot of friends who were musicians who were playing shows around town, and we would all hop around and pay $10 here and $15 here and $5 here to go see them. And it felt like we had so many friends that were musicians, and it felt like every night we were out at a different random place in Hollywood. And at the time we were all under 21. So like, while we had fake IDs, I'm sure it was like, like, I don't know where the under 21 places were that we were all going, but we were there. And I was like, what if everyone just played in my living room and it would be a lot easier and it could be free and we could just like hang out here. And that started Acoustic Nights. And yeah, we had, yeah, Katie was there, Mark Foster from Foster the People, and a lot of really cool, fun people that went on to do kind of crazy stuff over the years. But that became like a center of hangout, young LA.
Yeah, young LA. I mean, in retrospect, I imagine like, you know, like fuck the Whiskey a Go-Go or the Viper Room or something. It's like,
we're going to Acoustic Night.
Yeah, literally, like, I'm sure there are literally millions of people across the world to be like, I'd have loved to go to Revive Ullman's house and marry Mark Foster from Foster the People and just hang out in the living room with a whole bunch of actors, you know, that would be cool.
It was a good time. It was a time of a lot less cares. I'll say that much.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So, Revive, now that we have talked about this part of your life, getting, you know, your film and television career happening and coming to LA and establishing that part of your career, I do want to revisit that question of how do you feel your time with Disney Channel and the audience that you built up very quickly, shaped your life, but more so the rest of your career moving forward. What's your relationship been with that?
It's interesting. I mean, you mentioned before a new relationship with like social media. So at the time when we were on Disney, AJ, you and I, there was no social media. Instagram didn't exist. Twitter didn't exist. So now I think a lot of those kids that are on the shows like immediately have millions of followers and have a relationship with their fans and with the fans of those shows. At the time, it was a one-way street. Like I didn't have access to anyone and they didn't really have access to me. They had access like through the television, but there was no relationship and I wasn't providing my own content or my own thoughts. I was treated very well at Disney. It isn't like the Mauschwitz thing, but everything was controlled.
I've never heard that term.
You've never heard that? Great.
No, is that Mauschwitz isn't like you're trapped in there and that is the...
Well, because like, there is something to the old studio way, which you're under contract and you're not going to go and do work elsewhere, right? Like they kept us really busy. Like you said, like Keys to the Kingdom, what that meant in practice was that you filmed a TV show all week. On the weekends, you either went to shoot a PSA or went to Disneyland to do an event, or I was every weekend for a long time traveling around the country, doing events at schools, talking like with an Imagineer, talking about imagination. And like we worked hard and I loved every second of it and we were treated really well, but there wasn't time to go do a film somewhere else because we were working for Disney at the time. And that's how the old studio system ran. Like you got signed to a studio and that's who you worked for. So I think because that harkens, I think a lot of people with these ideas of, oh, they must've been terrible and they worked you to the bone. And again, like all I wanted to do was work. So I didn't see it that way. I think maybe for like really young kids, that can be a toxic or harmful thing. If like, again, we were all just kids and kids do have to be kids to some level. So any relationship with fans or anything like that was at, you know, at an event in a gymnasium in Kentucky. And now there's such a different relationship that actors or creators generally have with their audiences because they control their output. They control what is shared. And I almost feel like the careers are secondary to that. I feel like we as creators and artists have an outlet to our fans that we share exactly what we want. And then like sometimes we're going to be on a TV show as well. And that's a weird like turn of events. And also it's really cool because you get the opportunity to make things and share them with people. And maybe it'll make money, maybe it won't, but you get to be the creative person that like we originally set out to be. I think for a lot of us that started so young, at least for me, I can only speak for myself. I didn't get into it to make money. Like, I don't think I understood what success meant at the time, except for, like I said, working. And now with social media, like, it's all terrible. And social media is so destructive. And it's, like, obvious what it's done to our country. But at the same time, there's now a platform where we get to make things and share them. And so I think that had I had that opportunity at 17, I'd like to think maybe I would have used that to be really creative and share things. I don't know. Again, I was 17 and I was really focused on being a 17-year-old. But now it has opened some doors. I think like the relationship that I have with people on social media is due probably to the fact that there was a fan base there when I was younger. There was a big like decade in between when like social media really took hold. But it's nice to have a place to share things and feel like I'm going to try to get good at photography and share that with people. And I'm going to make short films and share that with people. And I have no idea which one of those things would, I don't know, take off or find success beyond a certain amount of likes. But
it's an interesting relationship because a lot of actors or even people famous for something, their relationship to things they did 10 or 15 years before aren't always separated by youth, you know, aren't separated something you did as a kid and then something you did as an adult. Normally, totally. It's just something you did as an adult. And so I wonder, though, throughout the years, have you ever, like, is there a point where you do sit there wondering if you send out a message that's politically leaning or you send out a message that is socially conscious and or really share your thoughts as a human being? Do they ever in your head run up against what fans of a Disney show might think of? Like, is that a part of your...
I don't think about that at all. And maybe I should.
No. I think it's great if you don't, but I just wonder.
Well, yeah, you lack the Disney slickness. You know, like when you would do those interstitials for Disney Channel and there's certain persona of Disney kids like, hey, guys, how's it going today? And I'm happy to be here and everything's great. That's one of the things that made you cool and a real person is you always lacked that Disney slickness that was present with most other Disney kids.
Oh, I appreciate that. I mean, again, like I do question what, you know, there's likely some opportunity in the fact that the show that brought me success is back on television and that I should use that as a good businessman to, but that's where the thought ends because I'm like, I do not know to do what.
Yeah.
And I don't want my creative energy to be focused on something that I did long ago and then get stuck there. That being said, I know a lot of people like Ali Mashaka, who played my friend on Phil of the Future, you know, she became a huge pop star with her sister and they have a group and they did a fundraiser where they were playing music and they brought all the different casts from all the different shows they'd been on over the years to do, you know, to come hang out. And it was all online. And they raised money for like 15 different charities. I was like, well, that's a really proactive, cool way to use that because you're not just like, come hang out because I was on a TV show, but we're going to, like, there's still forward movement. I haven't figured out how to intertwine the two. I feel like I've only been looking forward and perhaps I should figure out how to intertwine the two at least. But sometimes it does feel like you're using it but I definitely have never questioned whether I should share my opinions politically or otherwise on social media. My family my mom was a union worker. Like my grandfather was like a long line of activists and silencing myself to appease others has never been a part of the picture. And I've never questioned that. It doesn't always mean that I'm right or that I know what I'm talking about, but being loud and letting your voice be heard and realizing that there's a platform and people are listening. Like I don't like the whole like shut up and dribble thing, I think is insane. Like we're all humans. And the fact that some people have a platform and some people have less of a platform, like doesn't mean anything. Say what's in your mind. And so I do not care if people are offended by politically or social justice based thoughts. That is something that I'm willing to live with. How to, like the flip side of that is how to engage with those fans, if you want to call it that, or audience. Like that's something that I haven't cracked. It's something that makes me feel old. Like, you know, the kids on TikTok and social media who are, like know how to use it to engage with an audience and make a business. There's nothing wrong with that. I think that's amazing. I do not know how to do that. And don't know if I have the energy for it. Or
AJ and I, this is our problem. Is like, we've got this great podcast. We'd love to do this. So this sounds like something we'd love to spend our time on. What do we do with it now? We're barely on social media to begin with, you know?
I'm okay with if what I spend my time doing is putting my energy into creative projects that I believe in. If people see that, great. If they don't, then I've spent my time in a way that I enjoyed and I can watch a video with a puppet bear and be like, that's great, Raviv. That's really great. You did a good job. You know, like that's okay with me. I'm comfortable with that being a productive day. And I struggle with that, of course, because I'm like, okay, well, that didn't, you know, fill the coffers at all. But I'm okay if making a podcast and listening back to it or walking away from being like, that was a really fun, cool thing. And if 100 people listen to it, then fucking, that's awesome. And if it inspires someone somewhere, I don't know that this specific interview is very inspiring, but like if somebody is enjoying something, because I do believe that at the end of the day, that's what we're doing. Like there is all this social justice stuff. There's activism. There's doing work that means something and has an effect and positively changes the course of history. Like I believe that art has that power, no doubt, right? That's proven over and over again. Does that mean that everything we do has to have that effect, or that every piece of art that we make or every episode that we make have to reap immediate benefits? No way. That's impossible.
No way. Yeah.
And so the best we can do is continue to make things that we believe in. And whether that's conversations or a really good dinner or like a creative, like making a song, like, I don't know, there's a million different ways that we can be creative. And for those of us who started so young, I think it's just important to continue to remember, like, I'm really glad actually that I started really young, because I think had I started when I was older, it would have been all business and I would have been getting into it in a business. And that's something, again, that I struggle with. I'm like, I need to know how to run this business better if I'm going to survive and make it to my elder years. But if I can believe in the work that I'm doing on every scale, you know, from a podcast episode to a silly video to like a well-written tweet, as dumb as that sounds, like, okay, I'm contributing in the ways that I know how, and size of audience. And like, hopefully size of audience will depend on quality of work. Like that's like the best case scenario.
Chris, we're in trouble.
Uh-oh. Yeah, we're in such trouble. I mean, we love having these conversations, but we have no idea. Like, you know, we're realizing, oh yeah, it speaks to exactly where I think we're at right now, just in terms of becoming podcasters. And so, you know, it, which is all grown with social media in ways. And so we, you know, for us, we're former kid actors who were just like, give us the audition. And if we get the part, we'll show up and you guys do the rest.
Yeah.
And now we're like, oh, now we gotta be the employers in some capacity.
And well, I do appreciate your perspective on starting early and doing work to take the business out of it. When you start doing artistic endeavors as a young person, there's no business element associated with it. And to really be able to fully embrace that is unique to young people, or perhaps folks that have like nice trust funds that they can do artistic endeavors as adults and not have to worry about the financial end of it. But I'm curious if you are ever able to appreciate the work that you've done as a young person. For example, like with Phil getting re-released on Disney Plus, have you gone back and rewatched that at all or tried to appreciate what young Raviv was doing?
I can't do it. Not that I don't appreciate it. I mean, I've always had a thing where I can watch something that I've done on camera once, and then I can never watch it again because I will rip myself to shreds. Yeah. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm like totally justified in every note that I have for myself when I was 16. And I think I turned it on, like my girlfriend turned it on for saying, be like, this will be hilarious. And it was like, not.
And we broke up.
And it was not hilarious. You know? And again, I'm like, I don't even know if I got to this point, but like, I believe that the things that we make, the fact that they might bring joy to someone is amazing. And that was the joy of working on a show like Phil of the Future. And I'm sure even Steven, like the idea that we were invited into someone's house and they came home from school and they sat down and the parents got to go away and deal with something else or take a nap or do whatever they had to do. And a kid got to enjoy themselves and laugh at something. That is awesome. And that's something that I've recently come to terms with in terms of social media, people reaching out. I think I used to be, for a long time, I was embarrassed by like, oh yeah, well, that was me. And that was a job that I did and that's over. And now there's some joy in the idea that we made something that somebody enjoyed. And like, it's as simple as that. And it can be as simple as that. There's obviously so much else that goes into it and that you balance in your head of success and not success. But like looking back on that time, I think that's what's been most reflective now, you know, almost two decades later, is like, all right, we made something that people liked and they liked it around the world. And,
right.
You know, those audiences, while those shows were very popular, they were probably technically small because like, Disney Channel fans are so devoted and they run those episodes over and over and over again. So Kids know those episodes like the back of their, you know, the people who watch that show still to this day know the show better than I do. because they've seen the episode multiple times where I made it once. You know, I shot that scene one day when I was 16 and then moved on.
And that stayed with them in their life for a long time.
And that's beautiful, right? That's beautiful.
And especially that time in your life, there comes a point, I think, I don't know, you hit 22 years old and then you're like, all right, now every movie is only going to, I'm only going to remember it for a week, you know, unless it's really that special, you know? And so, but everything really imprints on you in that point. I'm just wondering, in the vein of that sentiment, do you think fans of your work then, I don't know, is there something you think they would love to hear or like an experience or story that you think about from that time that no one's ever heard?
This might be a little sensitive because it starts with the audition for Phil of the Future. So
I want it. AJ, I want to hear it. I want it
together. AJ, stop crying. Just relax.
I've never heard the Raviv side.
But I was testing for the show in LA and they had me read with Craig Anton, who ended up playing the father. And he was one of the funniest performers I had ever seen in my life. And I'm standing there in this room with, you know, a table full of executives staring at us. And I'm trying to do the scene with him, but I just can't stop laughing because every move that he makes is hysterical to me. And I thought, that's it. I fucked it up. I'm not going to get this because I couldn't even keep a straight face. And like, I had to be in the scene. When I found out that we both got the part, I was so ecstatic that I would get to work with people who were so much better than I was, who had like honed a craft for so many years, and something that TV and like, sometimes I think theater gets to do this because people get to sing a song or do a dance number and you're like, holy crap, I am witnessing how talented this person is. You know, I could never do what they're doing right now. Television doesn't really allow for that. Like, people get to be funny and people get to be good actors and cry or whatever it is, but you never get the full scope of talent. And that group of people were so talented and so funny. And I remember being so excited about the idea of like working with people who had spent their lives becoming really, really good at something. And it set an example for like what I should go out and do. And I don't know that I've done it. But
your story's far from over.
Yeah. Hopefully I've got a few more years left.
Well, but there's something about studying the art form as an adult and that sort of concerted effort versus learning on the job as a kid actor. And then it's common. A lot of people we've talked to have this coming to moment where they all of a sudden are an adult actor now and they go, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I was just like kind of, I got by doing something as a kid and people responded to it and it was fine, but I don't know what I'm doing now. Did you ever have an experience like that?
Yeah, I think the wide-eyed moment actually was was that where I was like, oh, I worked hard. You know, I never really felt like I was just getting by, but I realized that what I was offering and what I had been cast for, so what people were hiring me to do, it was possible that I no longer had that thing to offer. And it wasn't a matter of talent. It was a matter of like, we can be character actors, but you're never straying insanely far, right? And that what I had to offer had changed. And I think that's still something that I'm figuring out. Like, I felt like I knew what to bring to an audition because like there was a certain energy that I could walk in with and put that into a character and let that breathe life. And now I live my life with a different energy and have different thought patterns and have different weights and have different anxieties. So how do I then use that and turn that into a character, turn that into something? And again, like for me, there's a huge difference in theater and in film, because in theater you get to rehearse for a long time. So there's a long process of being able to figure that out. If you've been chosen to be that character, then you get to sit around a table for 3 weeks and discuss it and like tear text apart. And like, I love textual analysis. I think it's fascinating. And you get to then piece that together. With film, you show up and you get a couple of takes and you're done. And that idea still terrifies me. And it's likely why I haven't done so much of it lately. Because I don't know that I've figured out exactly how to breathe that, like this new Raviv into these new characters that I'm auditioning for.
I think that's a natural, I mean, I don't think you could act as long as you have and not go through that. It'd be strange if you didn't.
Yeah.
So when we say, hey man, would you like to come on and talk about your time as a kid actor? What comes to mind for you immediately? What did you think we would want to talk about? Or what would you want to talk about?
That's a really good question. I think part of my like looking to the future has, I don't know that I've buried anything. I don't think that there's anything highly traumatic that I've tried to run from, but I haven't spent a lot of time digging through that past. So I'm excited to talk to two people who have that lived experience. I've definitely given interviews before. It sounds like perhaps you've read one of them, where like you're having that conversation with someone who is a journalist or like is curious from the outside. And there's something fun that's trying to explain a lived experience, but having the conversation with two people who have lived it is a totally different thing. So I definitely question sometimes whether I should be doing specific interviews, especially concerning this thing, because I have no talking points. There's comfort in knowing that like, okay, I'm not only with two friends, but two people who have this shared experience that is very unique. You know, we've lived a unique life.
On that uniqueness thing with child actors, something you brought up early on and we didn't elaborate on it, but I want to ask you about it now is talking about maybe making some different decisions at that transition period.
Yes.
After Phil, after Pixel Perfect, you know, this catapult moment in your career. And I know a lot of people that are coming off of that have felt like, well, I can do anything now. I mean, everybody knows who I am. I was the title character on a television show. What was that era like immediately afterwards?
I'd say mostly desperation. No, I don't know.
That sounds like a joke, but you seem like you were really you were pontificating that question though right before you answered. Yeah, what was it like?
The first project that I did as soon as the show ended was a play at the Amundsen in Los Angeles, and it was another like big production of a big 45 cast members, and we had an orchestra pit filled with water that was a pool and like a 4-story set. And I dove into that. And I, for the whole summer of 2005, was doing this play. And so I had heard that the show got canceled and kind of thought, all right, I'm going to go back and do theater. Cause I'd left from the theater world to come to do this show. I was like, all right, if this isn't going to happen. And I was like, all right, I'm just going to dive back into this thing. And then you kind of get a guest spot and do like a couple of like recurring things. And then I did another series. I did a Lifetime sitcom. Lifetime tried their hand at doing multi-camera. They did it once for 2 seasons and never did it again. And I was honored to be a part of that. And then things started to slow down a little bit. And that's when I decided like, all right, let's go back to New York and focus on theater again.
What year, what age were you when things started to slow down?
Probably 23, 24. I think I was doing a couple guest spots here and there. And I was in a band that had just broken up and broken up with a relationship, and I was like, you know what, let's get out of LA for a little bit. Let's
speaking of, I don't want to jump past this little music thing, because there's one, you were in a band with you were in a band with Doug Smith. Was that the band that you broke up with?
That was the breakup band. Yeah, that was the breakup final band. Straw. Yeah.
That was it. And you're like, well, fuck you, Doug. I'm going to New York.
It's an emotional breaking up. It's an emotional thing. You dedicate so many hours of your life and you have so much wrapped up in it.
I don't know if I want to say more, but like a band is an intimate relationship with however many people are in that band. So, that band could be, there were like 7 of us too. And so you're breaking up with 7 people. And it definitely wasn't. And I had a relationship with somebody in that band. And so like the whole thing was just horrible at the end. But I mean, I'm still close with many, I would say all of them. And Doug is still a very close friend. But like the moment after the show, I think there is an expectation like, okay, I can go do anything. And I remember the president of Disney came to see the play that I was doing and came back afterwards. And somebody was saying like, oh, we come do this project or something. Like it was kind of like flying on top of the world kind of thing. And the president of Disney said, he's ours. And while it was like kind of a scary thing, I was like, I'm in. No, there's no stopping us now. And I don't know. And then nothing ever happened.
He never went on an audition. It doesn't sound like you were turning down opportunities,
but it's just like, well, where are the opportunities?
Yeah.
I'll take them. I'll do it. Guys, I'm ready to work. I'm ready to do stuff.
There were relationships that I had with people in positions of power that I did not keep up with, that now as an adult, I know that there are certain like relationships and business opportunities that you take advantage of, not because you're being smarmy, but because it's smart business. And I was just not focused on that. I was like, it was the kind of thing like, yeah, give me the audition and I'll go, rather than I've been given this great opportunity and come to LA and I've met people in power in this industry, and I should use those opportunities to either like try and make my own things or just stay in touch. And yeah. That's something that I was not good at. Can I blame that on like not getting straight offers from the heads of studios? I don't know. Could it be that my talents were to be on the Disney Channel on a kid's show and that didn't transfer to other things? I don't know. You know, I don't know how to trace those things. It's definitely not the kind of thing where I never look back and I never think, oh, I should have done that thing, or I probably shouldn't have made this thing, or I, you know, that horror film that I made, that was a really bad decision.
That's a rite of passage.
But that's a rite of passage.
Yeah. But what were you going to say right before that? Sorry to cut you off.
No, I was going to say the only thing that I can look back to that sometimes I'm like, was that a bad decision? I forget who is, this is terrible, but who was, there was two groups of guys that were in fake rap groups.
Yes, this is what I was going to bring up next. So I'm so glad you did.
Okay, good. Okay,
yeah, so this is the best because it is the first time, Googling you is the first time I have ever seen publicly in any fashion whatsoever, someone talk about the Weeby Boys, and the Weeby Boys was the rap group you were in that directly relates to the rap group I was in called Dem Cracka Blackjacks.
That's right.
And I was shocked. I was floored. I was like, what the fuck? Who knew about Weeby Boys? And yeah. I forgot you guys put the video out there. So this is where the Weeby Boys comes into my world as part of Dem Cracka Blackjacks.
Yeah.
So me, Andrew McFarlane, Dan Bird, John Foster, all take a trip to Europe. We got a Mac the first time Macs were out, and GarageBand is a brand new thing and you can make your own beats.
Glorious.
And we started making some beats and we started rapping for fun. 6 months later, we were like spending all day, every day writing rap songs and recording rap songs. And then within a year, Dan Bird, his mom left. Okay. His mom leaves the state and goes back to Georgia where he's from, gives up their two-bedroom apartment, says, this other bedroom's for whatever you want. When I come visit, or you can have a friend stay here, whatever. We immediately turn her bedroom into a recording studio. Hillary Duff gives Dan Bird her platinum record, and we put it up above our computer.
I did not know that part. That's amazing.
We basically smoke so many joints and just rap all day long, and that's all we did. And we created a rap group called Dem Cracka Blackjacks, and we loved it, and it was our like best, most fun nothing to do in life, and it was like the biggest joke taken very seriously. And then at one point, Andrew McFarlane shows up, and he goes, "We got a problem." I was like, what's that? And he goes, you know, Raviv, and it was Adam Rose too, right? So it's Raviv, Adam Rose. Who else was in
it? Who else was in it?
There was a big old crew of people. We had Evan Peters.
Yeah.
And Greg Roman, Mike Mitchell, Sam Murphy, a whole slew.
Yeah, there's a whole slew. And Andrew shows up and he goes, just got to tell you guys something, we got a problem. Like, what? He's like, there's another rap group in town. Like, what? He goes, they're called the Weeby Boys. And literally that night, we had stopped everything we were doing. I think we had like auditions the next day. We stopped everything and we created our first diss track against the Weeby Boys called Weeby Murderers.
We came out so hard that
I remember, yeah, it was like, you guys are sort of like, dude, we would have signed up for this, but we're not going to sign up for this because this isn't even fun. You guys took this way too serious.
Well,
that was it. We shot a music video and we did a whole thing.
But
and,
then we answered it with a with
you answered track. It. Exactly.
I think we went back and forth track. Two or three times.
Exactly.
And if then we can, we really should put the two tracks
no,
in the show.
No,
no
we shouldn't.
We should
here's
not.
What, no, we shouldn't. Because oh, here's okay. here's what happened is why it actually stopped is all of us, I remember all of us sitting there. And, you know, we're all actors. Everybody involved is an actor. We all have some aspiring careers to live up to at that point. And so we like, I remember we all just went, dude, we can't put this out there. Like, this would get a lot of us in a lot of fucking trouble, at least on our end, because we were saying some things that were not okay.
Well, like, I think, you know, that was like where the diverging roads happened. You guys said, there's no way that we should put this out there. And we said, let's make a music video and put it on YouTube immediately.
And you did. Exactly. That's where we went, oh no. And it was, I remember that conversation. Dan Bird was on like an ABC Family show and he was like, dude, guys, I don't know if this gets me in trouble. And I, and like John and I had just been up for some other show that was, you know, like real family friendly. And I'm saying things like, put it in the butt, put it in the butt, butt, put it, you know, and I'm like, I don't know if this will be a blemish or something.
Oh, God.
You know, just saying horrible shit. And I don't know if it's going to have any effect or if it could. We don't know. We've never done anything like that. And so, well, we washed it right there. We're like, we're going
to
wrap
to remember up about that time too, like the beginning of social media, like it was the kind of the beginning of YouTube.
It was, like, it was the very,
yeah, it was the very beginning, which is hard to think about now or understand, yeah, what that time was like. But the idea, yeah, of putting something on YouTube and it going viral, like viral wasn't yet a thing. You guys were actually way ahead of the curve in thinking about
consequences, repercussions.
Repercussions, yeah. And we were, well, because the thing, we had an acoustic night the next night after we recorded the song, and we decided, you know what, let's record a song and shoot a music video for it in 24 hours. It'll be like our own little made up film festival, and then we'll send it to the guys and it'll, and the diss track will go. And we did, and then it, and people started watching it because I was fresh off of a Disney Channel show.
I think that's actually what scared us, is people did watch it and we went, oh fuck, man, because the video we were shooting had our friend John Foster's actual guns in it that he owned, and we were like, and sure. That's what Dan was like, dude, I don't know if I can be in a video with like sawed off shotguns, John. He was like, what do you mean? He's like, I'm on an ABC show, a family, but I can't do this. So yeah, that became a very big question.
And so like, that's something that I look back on with great fondness.
Yeah.
I have no idea, because I don't know the power. I still don't understand the power of these things. Like, did that ever have an effect on, like, was there an audition that I had that I was up for something and some executive was like,
he's a weeby boy.
Yeah. We can't have that kind of ruffian around here. It's entirely possible. I don't regret having made a silly thing with my friends and putting it out there. Like, again, it was just another form of expression. And looking now, like, how many kids on Disney have had all kinds of content, sex tapes and curse things and drugs and like going to rehab and continue to work for the channels and continue to work in general. So I don't, again, it's like, I don't know how to trace what affected what or what set what into action. It's the only time that I look back though and think like, maybe I shouldn't have been acting like a 17-year-old. Maybe that was a time where I could have been more thoughtful about a step that I was taking, but who knows? I definitely have no regrets looking back at any of it. I am a content person, not necessarily with the state of the world, but with my own day to day most of the time. So I don't regret any of it. I do think too, I don't know, this is one more interesting thought that just popped in my head, but that with the advent of social media and the idea of an artist, like the idea now that you are a social media star or a person that has this relationship with your fans, and then you're on television. The difference between an artist and the human, that line is super gray now, or perhaps doesn't exist at all. Back then, I was an actor and acting. So even when I went out and did these talks about imagination, like I was still the actor from Disney Channel doing this thing. It wasn't me. In fact, I was going by a different name. I was going by Ricky at the time. So like, it didn't feel like me. So I did feel like, wait, totally two separate lives, that one I could go and do whatever I wanted and walk my own line and to the tune of my own drummer. And the other was I was going to show up to work. Again, who knows? I have no idea.
Why did you rename yourself Ricky?
I was 8 years old when I got my manager, and I was auditioning for All American looking kids. And I was told that they were submitting me for parts, but I wasn't getting the auditions because they would first just see a list of names and see Raviv and say that's too ethnic. And so I couldn't get in the door to get the auditions. And so I was advised to take a stage name that was more generic and went by randomly, because I had like, you know, an hour to do it, chose Ricky. And then the first job that I got was playing Aziz, the Muslim boy in some terrible action movie.
Like, we don't want to see Raviv for this Aziz role, but we'll definitely see Ricky.
Definitely see Ricky. That sounds perfect.
If there isn't a better example of that particular time, for sure, in the entertainment industry.
That was it.
That's it.
Well, Chris, you went through the same thing.
I did, yeah, with my last name. The exact same thing. Yeah. So my last name is my mother's maiden name, for the same reason. They said, look, we're sending you out. they're not seeing you because they're just seeing this name, and no matter how much we try to push them, they won't see you. And so they said, we got to change your name to a more white looking name. My dad's a Cuban immigrant, and I'm so scared to share it too, because I heard this actor get trashed on a couple years ago, like all on social media, because she came out and admitted that she had changed her name for the same reason. And then there was like this huge amount of, I mean, nobody gives a shit about me online, but they trashed this poor actress. And she was sitting there going, you guys don't understand what it's like to break into acting. And sometimes the things it's,
I heard of the more problematic version of this recently, where somebody recently had changed their name to a more, even though they weren't, to like a more Hispanic sounding name.
Oh, to try to,
Yeah.
I wish it was that. That I can see, like, maybe could cause some controversy. You know, this other actress and me, the thing we had in common is we were actually told to sound more white.
Right.
Because my last name's Rodriguez. And they were like, it's not flying, guy. They're not going to see you to play Josh. You know, like, it's not working. And, you know, and then I changed my name to Marquette.
Yeah.
And they went, and all of a sudden I get auditions and I start working.
Yeah. Like, I mean, as soon as I changed my name, the audition started coming. So, like, it was definitely a real thing.
Yeah. And then you changed your name back when you were 18, or like, when did that?
After Phil of the Future, actually. I had gotten a role on House at some point and decided I was just like tired of seeing someone else's name on the screen and wanted to take ownership of the career. And nobody knew me as Ricky. I mean, like, my friends didn't know me as Ricky at all. Nobody called me that I knew. So I just decided to change it back. Maybe that was where I went wrong. Was it changing names mid-career? Definitely possible. Change it back
to Ricky next year, and we're like, and he won a Golden Globe within 6 months.
Totally possible. Again, it's just like, I don't know. I have a real problem with authority and being told what to do. And I know I get that from my mother. And so, like, playing the game is really hard for me, and it's something that I have never done well and probably should attempt to do more often. Generally, looking back, trying to think of like what can you do differently over time? But I think that is something that's deep within me. And so I'm going to end up doing what feels right in that moment and hope that it sticks somehow somewhere.
Did you ever feel like you had, and maybe you still do, certain mentors that you did make relationships with as a kid actor that have stayed in your life to this point and either helped you with cinematography or directing or other creative pursuits?
Well, so when I started thinking about directing more and more and realizing that I had a lot to learn, I very nervously reached out to a list of people, of directors and artists that I reached out to, who were immediately welcoming and invited me on set and opened the door. And I think you realize that everyone had mentors growing up somehow. Everyone had somebody who helped them, and that people are a lot more willing to help the next generation than you might think. But there was a guy, Rodney Charters, who is this unbelievable New Zealand cinematographer. He did the entire series of 24, and he worked on like all of these kind of epic TV shows over the year, and he worked on Pixel Perfect, actually, and we became fast buddies, and even though he was far older than I, but I just was always hanging out by the camera. And when I moved to LA, he invited me kind of on set wherever he was, and just kind of gave, I had like an all access pass to the set of 24. So just when I moved to LA, I just hung out on the set of 24, like terrified of Kiefer Sutherland. It was just like hardcore, you know. I was coming off of like all those like on Disney sets during the day, and then at night going out to Santa Clarita to go like visit the Kiefer doing his like stunts or whatever. There are definitely people who I did stay in touch with who've been like kind of shining lights throughout time. That's somebody that pops to mind.
Yeah, that's great. And I think it's important to keep in mind that I don't know that there's other like aspiring kid actors listening to this or people.
Please,
that are
AJ, stop it. Just stop.
Whatever.
It.
I'm just saying it's good advice for people to make mentors. It's like an important part of life. It's,
you know who you sound like right now?
Who?
Who do you think you sound like right now?
Who?
Don't say it.
That's who you sound Don't like right it. Now, AJ. Don't say it. Don't exactly say it. Who you sound like right now. I'm not kidding you. That is it. You've become your own mother. So wait, real fast. This is not.
Let me support him in the way that like when you're a kid, there is a thing about being cool, or like that being curious isn't cool because so much of the arts are deemed nerdy, right? Like whether it's dance lessons, voice, like whether it's going to lessons or being interested in like camera work, or none of that is cool. But the more curious you can be, like the more you're going to learn because you have access to things. And the same thing for theater, for anything.
And you go find your own, you know, we all found each other. I mean, you were singing Broadway tunes. You were singing Broadway tunes in the hallway and a teacher stopped you and said, hey, you know, I can't imagine you were the high school quarterback prom king.
I was not either. You know, I was definitely not cool. There's no cool aspect to anything that I was doing.
You became a target. Yeah,
no, 100%.
Yeah. Well, before we get to our last couple of questions, I want you to tell us a little bit about your podcast because it sounds really fascinating. To us, it sounds completely in line with how we know you personally in that, you know, the most time I think I've spent with you hanging out besides at the Wilton Hilton back in the day was, you know, you hold a really beautiful Shabbat dinner at times. And and I've been able to come and show up and be a part of a very loving, awesome group of people that you put together. And it sounds like that sentiment in your life has translated into this endeavor with a podcast. And we just want to hear about it.
Well, thanks for asking. Yeah, I've been hosting Shabbat dinners for a long time, both in LA and New York. And it was always a matter of community building. It was like an excuse to get together with friends and be around a table. And I'm really into ritual and building ritual around friends and having a space to hold as sacred in some way, whatever that means to each person. And I was doing all these things and I grew up in a Jewish household and definitely grew up Jewish culturally and with Jewish practices. And was continuing on these traditions of holding Shabbat dinners and saying the prayers and holding space for something bigger than ourselves. But my relationship with the basis for Judaism and the basis for religious beliefs in general was always something that I've wrestled with and questioned and was never something that I've been absolutely certain about. I don't know exactly what I think God is at any given moment. I go back and forth between agnostic beliefs and really religious thoughts and definitely don't fall in one place. And that also for me is like where Judaism actually lies and how I was brought up is like that questioning is a huge part of the religion and of the practice and that you're not necessarily supposed to know one way or the other. But it suddenly felt important to me that since I was hosting these things that I should engage a little bit more with what I was spreading. And it was time to actually learn something rather than just host space. And the textual basis for Judaism, Christianity, and Islam is the Torah. It's the first book that we were given. And I wanted to go through it. And there's a tradition in Judaism on Shabbat. You know, so the way that the Torah works is that every week you go through a different portion and then you get to the end of it after a year and you just start at the beginning again and you just read it and talk about it. And studying Torah is a big part of Jewish life or can be, but it never was a part of mine. And when we went into the pandemic and we started doing Zoom Shabbats and Shabbats became less about a Friday night hang with friends, even though we did the prayers and we made chachala and had wine and said Kiddush. It was all of a sudden being on Zoom was now I am hosting some kind of experience. People are coming not just for a hang and we're not just hanging around drinking wine and eating dinner. Now, like this is an hour that people are on a Zoom and what does that mean and what can we offer this experience? And so I started adding a Devar Torah, which is you read that week's portion of Torah and you just kind of pontificate on it. And there are centuries and centuries or thousands of years of teachings and unpackings of this text that you can read all over the place. And so I started to kind of do my own. And at some point I was trying to figure out what to do with myself in quarantine. And my girlfriend Julie said, well, what if you make the Devar Torah into a podcast and just invite interesting people on to talk about this ancient text? And I said, well, that's not a bad idea. And I called a friend who's a rabbi and a teacher at American Jewish University, who I had taken his class, kind of asked like, well, what you were to recommend a book or what should I know if I were to take on this undertaking? Because I'm not a rabbi. I have never studied this text since I was, 9 years old, probably. And he said, well, I'd do it with you. And so now we just invite all kinds of friends. Vanessa Chester is coming on in a few, so I know was here. Cool. And we've got neuroscientists and climatologists and professors of English and reverends and thought leaders in all different spaces, religious and non. We have agnostic people on, believers and non-believers, and just unpack a portion of Torah and try to apply it to today in any possible way. And that's come out in so many, it's come out in so many beautiful conversations. And while it is, I guess, at its heart, a Bible study, that is not at all what it has been in practice. Like I that calling it that kind of irks me, even though that is absolutely what it is. But it is really just on taking this old text that has stuck around for thousands of years for some reason and has caused all kinds of problems as well, right? It's not only brought peace and love, and trying to understand what gave birth to so much thought and so much wisdom and so much hatred and, you know, all war and peace and famine. Like this text has done a lot of work in a few thousand years. And so we're just trying to take a little bit of a closer look to understand what lessons might be there, what lessons have been taken from it, and discuss that with friends. And it has been just an incredible experience to make that kind of my homework for a little bit.
It's beautiful.
I mean, thank you. Awesome. Thank you.
So it does definitely speak to, I think, the, you know, I've only been to a couple of Shabbats that you held, and we had a lot of our friends like Aaron and an old friend Dove, you know, held Shabbat dinners.
Oh yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, exactly. And they were the worst Shabbat dinners in comparison.
No, they did a great job.
No, they did do a great job. But also to me, it always felt like the difference between a Shabbat dinner and a dinner with friends was that you came there in a different capacity and you left there in a different capacity. Mm, and there wasn't, there was a nice space that is held that isn't just held when you're just having a barbecue or a birthday dinner, whatever other reason. You know,
it's really interesting to like add intention as a lens for an experience. And I think that, you know, theater offers that. I think sitting down in a movie theater can offer that, and reading a book can offer that. But as a group experience, I'm so into helping foster community space.
And I think you're right. It's in the intention, because no one says like, oh no, we're just going to go hang. Oh, just a party, which immediately sets a tone. And when someone says, no, everybody's going to have Shabbat dinner, and particularly that silence that everybody observes, I feel like is more than anything, at least forces your attention somewhere different inside.
The whole thing has been really wild, because they're probably like being a kid actor. There are like pieces of religious practice that when you grow up with them and they're kind of second nature to you, once you try to like share that with friends outside of your space, feel embarrassing. So like asking 20 people to wash their hands and stay quiet before you cut a piece of bread and then everyone eats it. Like, you're like, this is kind of embarrassing to ask people to do, but then it's everyone's favorite part of the night.
I love it.
I think because you're right. I think that, I mean, there's a craving for spirituality in life. And so it's really wonderful. When I heard even just vaguely what you're podcast is about, I thought that's so wonderful. I mean, I see that enacted in those dinners, and it seems like you feel like that. I always get the sense from you that you hold space for yourself with depth and with a seeking attitude. And so it's really nice. And it's nice you found that. And I look forward to listening. And if you ever need another former kid actor,
I would love you guys to come on.
I'd love to come on.
It's offered us to is a place to engage with like the immediate world that can be really overwhelming. So like, I don't want to sit around with friends, even though I do it all the time anyway, and talk about politics, or like, it's sometimes hard to talk about social justice issues and like know exactly where to start that conversation. But if you actually start somewhere else and you're like, we're going to start with this window tonight, this sentence of a text from thousands of years ago, and we're just going to talk about what that means. And it can mean anything, and that conversation can go anywhere. We're not going to talk about what God is telling us in this word, and totally admitting that like a bunch of men wrote this thousands of years ago. And that, and so much of it is problematic and misogynistic. And like, we're going to unpack that and talk about what that means and how do we trace those issues and like, how do we get to where we are today? It's offered both a lens and a window to access conversations that are sometimes really hard to like, to roll into. And that's been a gift
as
well.
You're bringing religion in the 21st century. That's really nice, man. So this will bring us to our last couple questions. I believe. AJ, you want to start out with the first one this time?
Yeah. Second.
Oh, how exciting. Yeah. I'm glad I'm here for this.
Raviv, if you had kids in the future and they came to you at some point and said that they wanted to become actors at a young age, what would your answer be? Is that something you'd allow your offspring to do?
I only know how to parent from my own parents, but I do believe that they instilled something in us that I would be happy to pass down, which is, you are allowed to do anything you want as long as it's not hurting someone else and you work really hard for it. So if my kid wanted to be an actor, yeah, I don't have a problem. Like, I was watching before this, I was sitting when we were watching the Greta Thunberg documentary. There's like a new Greta doc. And it's like, here's a dad who allowed his kid to skip school and like sit in front of parliament with a sign and protest every day. And look at what that has accomplished. If you are down to work hard for something and not fuck off, I will support that. And I think that goes for acting as well. So I think I would support that. I can't think of anything that I would say, no, you are not allowed as a kid to do if you work hard. But let's see, when I have a kid, maybe we'll circle back around and I'll say, absolutely not, stay at home.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, this leads us to our last question, yeah. Which is, when you turned 18, how'd you spend your Coogan account money?
That's really funny. I so because I was born on a commune and then we came to America with nothing, my father is incredibly financially conservative and instilled in me a great fear of spending any money at all for anything, which brings great joy to my romantic partners. So I saved everything, which I think that's the only advice that I could share to anyone getting in, is just save your goddamn money, because yeah, don't, you're going to need it.
Between the ages of 18 and 38.
I still have the same car I bought when I was 16, but I think I just saved it and it's still just sitting there.
That's great. Look at that.
I don't think it is actually sitting there anymore at all. Yeah. I think there's very little sitting there, but was there a moment when you guys turned 18 and you're like, woohoo!
Just went absolutely nuts.
Fuck yeah.
I wish I had done.
No, you don't. No, you don't. You had great parents.
You guys are doing it. There's no wrong way.
Well, dude, okay, I want to start off saying we really appreciate you here.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. It's so fun to hang out with you guys.
And it is. It's so great to connect with you in this way and in this medium too. And it's so nice. I hope, if anything, as you kind of said, you know, you looking back in within this lens hasn't necessarily been a part of your life ever since you were acting as a kid. And I hope we were able to give you a friendly perspective that, like, you are really remarkable guy. Seem to have grown so fluidly in your life, and you seem, as you've always struck me from the time I met you first to today, seem very centered in yourself, very comfortable in your own skin, very attentive towards the world, and not quite dwelling on yourself and that you've like battled it out with. You seem like someone who has always flowed really pretty easily in your life. And I don't know if you realize that is not, I'd say that's a very rare case.
I really appreciate that. Oh, that's very kind. Like, there are loops for everyone, right? We all have these things that like we can't quite shake, but forward is the only direction that we're heading, even though we all come from the past. So I was going to say, my grandfather, may he rest in peace, always told us, he said, life is good, don't make it bad. And I do fiercely believe that. I think that there is a lot out there that needs to change, and we all have to work hard to make change. But life itself is a good thing. And you know, I'm just happy to be here.
Amen.
Well, we're happy we're here with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
We really appreciate all your time, and we will talk again soon.
Can't wait. Thank you. Thank you.
Yo, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Go ahead, AJ. Let it go. Let it rip. What,
are we doing yo on the intro and the outro?
We're doing yo whenever we can fit a yo in. Yo, yo, what's up? What's up, guys? Thanks so much for listening. They're done. They're done. We got to let them go. Thank you guys for listening. I hope you had a wonderful time. Isn't Review peachy? If you liked it, rate us, review us, tell some friends, post about us, hit us up. We've been having such cool dialogue with everybody online. Also, we're going to start gearing up to record our podcast with a visual element coming up soon. So get ready for that. That's going to be cool. You'll be able to check us out on YouTube and see our faces. You know what AJ's face looks like right now? Exactly like it did when we met at 14. He got the exact same haircut this week. It's silly. It's sad. He should be embarrassed. It's like the last 20 years never happened. He looks like he's back on the Disney Channel, surfing and skateboarding and playing guitar and trying to look super cool and get those ladies all worked up and excited. That's exactly what AJ looks like right now. And his laughter tells you that I'm not making this up. We're going to post a cool picture of AJ's awesome 90s hair, and we'll put it out there for you guys to enjoy. Or maybe we'll put it on Reddit for one of those roast me things. That's what'll happen. Thanks, guys. Hope you had a great time.